Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner and welcome to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in the 2017 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference in Melbourne. Starting on the 8th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Juliet Marillier, and Deborah Challenor, and our podcast guests Kate Forsyth, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Solaria Gentile, and Robert Gott. You can find out more or buy tickets online at hnsa.org.au. In this episode, we talk to two writers from New Zealand who between them have written about a huge range of topics and in fiction and non-fiction. Nahuia Te Awakatuku is a professor of research at the University of Waikato. She has worked in museums, taught art history and Maori studies, and has written extensively on issues of gender and sexuality and about Maori cultural practice. Her books include Ruahini, Mythic Woman, Traditional Stories Told and Retold, and Tahuri, Stories About Two Young Women Coming of Age. Deborah Challenor is a historian who writes best-selling fiction. Her novels include The Convict Girls, Smuggler's Wife and Children of War series. Deborah has also written non-fiction, Grey Ghosts on New Zealand soldiers and the Vietnam War, and Who'll Stop the Rain about the effects of Agent Orange on the children of New Zealand's Vietnam veterans. Her books are sold in the UK, Germany, Russia and Czechoslovakia, as well as Australia, and regularly top the New Zealand bestseller lists. She's one of the few people who has actually taught researching and writing historical fiction for the History Department at Waikato University. And these two happen to be very good mates. So, welcome, you two. We first met at the 2015 conference in Sydney, and one of the issues that arose there, as it does so often, was the question of identity in storytelling. The writers' identities, the stories they tell, the worldview of the past that we try to convey. That's now been taken up as the theme of the 2017 conference. So I wondered about your thoughts on the question of, are we as writers always working from or about or into identity of some kind?
I think we do. I think we have to, because we are who we are, and we always write from a place of who we are, whether we mean to or not, whether it's ethnic identity or cultural identity. And I think if you write from the heart, that always shows through whether you mean it to or not. What do you think, Nahuia?
I agree with Deborah. I think that one of the challenges and the most exciting adventures a writer can go on is the opportunity to assert different elements and parts of oneself, but not just the way that one is, but the way that one would like to be. And often in the whole notion of identity, for me anyway, you can really tell whether a piece works well or not, or whether a writer is real or not, by the authenticity of the voice, which comes from the authenticity of identity. And, you know, certainly demonstrated in historical fiction for me. It's a big question. I mean, the whole notion of identity is a constant series of movements and fluidities, and it's just kind of huge. But as I said, it's massively challenging and exciting too.
It's got those layers too, doesn't it, with historical fiction, because you're say we're working from our own identity or senses of identity, which may or may not be fixed, and then we're looking at people who, in the past, we have to try and get inside their identities, their sense of their worldviews, their sense of self, their sense of the world and relationships that might be quite different to our own.
I know, and they could have been hugely different. Say, for example, with my writing, I have my own self, my sense of identity now and my view of the world. But when I'm writing my characters, say in the 19th century, their view of the world probably was, or definitely was, hugely different from mine now. But I have to put myself in my character's shoes, and they will say and do things that might horrify me now, but I have to do them for historical authenticity. And it gives me a huge sense of freedom, to be honest, to have my characters do that, which is awful in a way for me, but lets me see what it might have been like back then. But I also manage, of course, to have characters that have the opposite views as well, so that I'm able to show the two sides of the story in my novels. But it's really important for me not to, you know, marinate my novels in 21st century points of view, because then they're just not authentic.
And one of the things I've noticed in your books, Deborah, is that the past world you create is populated by a much more diverse cast of characters, say in terms of culture but also gender, with these stroppy heroines the centre stage, than we sometimes see in historical fiction. Thinking about, say, the Goldfields, you know, communities much more culturally diverse than we often see. Is that a conscious decision?
Well, it's a decision that's based on research.
Yeah.
So it's authentic. It's based on research, so it's real. A lot of Western historical received wisdom is based on Western history, which does tend to leave out a lot of ethnic groups like Chinese history and Māori history. There were quite a number of Māori gold miners, and people go, what? But there were. And of course, people are aware of Chinese gold miners, but they're not aware of the huge impact that they had on the gold field. So why not write about it? Mm. So I do. And women had quite an impact on the gold fields, even though there weren't many, but there were a lot of female business owners and that sort of thing. So I like to write about what isn't quite so well known about. I mean, it's just so interesting. And everybody else has written about the ordinary white gold miners, if we want to take the gold miners as an example. I don't want to, because it's been done. I like to go to places that haven't been looked at before.
So for both of you, I mean, you've both got academic backgrounds in a whole lot of different research interest areas, but it seems to me that a lot of them are about to do with the past and to do with looking at the impact of the past on the present. Why does history matter?
Shall I answer that one?
Yeah, go for it.
Nahuia.
Well, you know, although personally I have multiple identities and many different streams that converge to make me whom I am, and you know, some originating in the Arctic Circle and others here in the islands of the Pacific, and yet others in Paris and Oxford. You know, I'm this kind of great confluence of all sorts of different things. And what I find gripping about all of that is that each stream has its own series of desires, of expectations, of crises, of origin stories. And as my primary identity, and I'll say that very consciously, is a Māori, an Indigenous person of Aotearoa New Zealand, what has always fascinated me is the way that our experience of 19th century Aotearoa has been so often recorded and presented back to us through the writings and the observations of amateur gentlemen scholars and colonial officials. So the challenge for me and for other Māori writers and researchers is to turn that upside down and to challenge it and to engage with another point of view. One of the other trails that I follow as well is examining and reviewing and then twisting and turning upside down my own Māori history, because even though we are a pre-literate people, we have a massive oral tradition. And the type of literature that I grew up with and that I still rejoice in is not unlike other really intense and Homeric and remarkable narratives. And for me as a Māori now, as a Māori woman, a Māori lesbian and a kind of Māori thinker, the challenge is to turn those around and look at them again, because so many of them, particularly stories concerning women, have been interpreted and presented through the male eye and with a male identity focus. And so that's one of my kind of big adventures as a writer too.
Because you've actually got a book of those tales retold through a different, or well, many different lenses, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I have Ruahine Mythic Women, in which I take eight of my own ancestors and turn them around. And much of my interpretation is based actually on my understanding and deconstructing of the original pre-European narrative. And other gentlemen scholars and the contemporary writers, including Māori, take the euphonized and scandalized 19th century view and built the new stories or republished the stories on those bases. And in Ruahine, I just say, no, no way, that's not how it happened.
So it looks, it seems like both of you are doing a bit of deconstruction of that narrative, that especially that 19th century recorded narrative and worldview. And one of the things I think in both Australia and New Zealand is that there are so many historical novels set in that phase, particularly in that phase of colonialism or in reaction to that phase of European colonisation and the huge immigration surges that happened during the gold rushes in both countries too. So why do you think it is that that is something that writers and readers revisit so often and seem to really want to understand, that process of contact and colonisation?
I think because it's close enough to now to mean something to people. I mean, people can look back and say, oh, that was my, you know, great, great, great grandfather or mother who did that. And it still has, you know, it has meaning to them. They can count back and they can go back on, they can go to ancestry.com and find their ancestors who did it. It's, you know, it's not too far back in history for them to find out about it themselves. They can visit graves, they can go to places, they can find streets where people live. So it has relevance to them. It's not like the 15th or the 16th century. So it is close enough to have real meaning to them. They can walk around streets. I mean, I have people who say to me, oh, I went to the rocks and I walked around all those streets that were in your books and it was amazing. It was like I was really there. And or I went to the street and I went to that street where your characters walked in, and that's where my, you know, great Thomas Reed grandfather lived. And, you know, it's that, you know, the mid 19th century is not that far away for people, and I think that's why it's appealing to them.
So it's kind of within imaginative reach.
It is.
Yeah, and just to extend on what Deborah has said, the ephemera, the artifacts, the textures, the smells are still there.
Mm. Yeah. And people have still have photos from, you know, there are photos from the 1860s, and, you know, some clothing is still left over. There's furniture.
Jewellery.
Yeah, jewellery, mourning jewellery, all that sort of thing. You know, it's touchable. It's still there. It's still there. But whereas, you know, the previous century, it's fading. It's nearly gone.
I also think, too, that there's, for some of our writers, or some people whom I know, and I don't mean Deb at this point, there's a compulsion to explain, to justify. I'm thinking of a number of self-published books about local history produced by local families, primarily white, about their right to be in a particular community, treating these paddocks and these pine trees as their realm, as their exclusive domain. And so there's that whole aspect of the recording through fiction or through vanity press of our country's past. And I have great fun challenging that stuff, I really do. And some of our earlier writers, of course, here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, did exactly that. And I think of people like, well, the first one that comes to mind is Jane Mander, but another one that comes to mind, even though she's certainly our most celebrated expat writer, is Mansfield, Catherine, and the work that she did in the volcanic plateau and crossing Te Urewera. And for me, she's always been an object of intense fascination, primarily because most of her early romance, well, her two principal romantic sapphic liaisons were with Māori women and women of aristocratic background, but nevertheless Māori. And you never hear that said out loud very much. But, you know,
it's a world exclusive right there, folks.
I don't know. I think there's been some writing about it somewhere. Jill Boddy did something on it years ago, Gillian Boddy. But, it's I think, well, for me anyway, as one of the original, one of the Māori people of these islands, an ongoing and fascinating view on the descendants of those that came in the 19th century and how they saw and how they continue to see those arrivals.
So it goes back to what Deborah was saying before about being conscious about not projecting your own ideologies onto the characters of the past, because that is the process that's going on there, isn't it? Those, whatever they might be, whatever our impulse is, whether it is still continuing the colonial process or the saying, this is my space and I have taken it.
It is. It's myth-making. It's ongoing myth-making. And it's, you know, keeping the wolf of insignificance from the door, you know? this is what happened in my family, and you know, that these were my magnificent ancestors, and which is what people do with their memories, isn't it?
What you were describing before is the process of being much more self-aware of that process happening when you're writing fiction.
I think it is a good idea to try and be much more self-aware. I really do think it's a good idea to be. Otherwise, you can get caught up in projecting your own 21st century views onto your 19th century novel, which I feel makes it inauthentic. And it's not easy to avoid that, I have to say. It really isn't easy, which is why you should really have a really good editor.
That's right. I was just going to ask about the process of storytelling, because you've both written across different forms and on different subjects, from soldiers in the Vietnam War to art history and tattoos, fiction and non-fiction, essays, academic work. Is the process of telling a story always the same, or do you actually have to think in different ways when you're writing in different forms?
It is really quite different. I wrote two non-fictions before I wrote fiction, and when I changed from non-fiction to fiction, I felt like I was stepping off a cliff. It was really quite a scary feeling writing with no footnotes. It really was. I thought, because what I went from two non-fictions on the Vietnam War, which were heavily footnoted, very heavily footnoted, because they were based on academic works, to fiction, which I had researched using the same academic methodology that I had used for non-fiction, but of course there were no footnotes, and I felt nude. I really did. I thought, how am I going to prove that what I am saying in this novel is true? How are people going to know that I haven't made all this up? And I just felt utterly naked. I really did. And it took quite a few novels before that feeling wore off.
The naked historian. That's what you can call your memoir.
I should, shouldn't I? It really was a scary feeling. It's gone now, but I've written 15 novels now.
That's right.
Yeah, but it was a yuck feeling. It really was.
Moving from that historian frame of reference to the fiction frame of reference. But that's interesting that you still use the same methodology then. Do you still use your research methodology now?
Yes, I do.
In writing fiction?
Yeah, I do. I do, because I can't stand sloppy research, and I hate it when I notice it when someone else has done it. Drives me mental. If it takes me 3 days to find something correctly, I'll bloody well find it.
I haven't written a novel yet. I've written lots of stories, and I've done some major non-fiction and scholarly work. And it's interesting because I absolutely and utterly support and agree with Deb's commentary. And my self-descriptor, though, would be not naked but exposed. And I think that in the working of fiction, you are taking a risk to show bits of yourself or of your inner workings or of a particular process or of the creation of new beings that never happened before. And it's a really scary process. I mean, I've been trying to write long fiction as in contrast to short fiction for years, and it's just never happened because part of the challenge has been this is really scary shit, and I'd be much better off writing a good essay or doing another journal article or editing another catalogue or, you know, doing something that's relatively easy. And that is footnoted and that is academically sound, and that can be subject to scrutiny. And therefore, untouchable in a way. Whereas with fiction, I think that the certainly long fiction novel writing, I think the writer is at risk. I think there's stuff that's very exposing, and as Deb so eloquently described, is naked making. You end up naked. You end up, yeah, you're out there. Another point I'd like to make as well is that, like Deb, I'm an academic, and for many years that has been my lifestyle and principal source of income. And I really lose it, I really do, when I see sloppiness and, oh, this will be okay, this will do, in the work of particularly established novelists. And I won't name names, but I can think of three or four whose Māori stuff, like whose indigenous Aotearoa New Zealand material, would never pass one of my exams in first year, because the stuff they're writing is naive, it's insulting, and it's bizarre. And there's no excuse for that.
These are Pākehā writers.
No. Ah. I, that's why I said I wasn't going to name names, but okay. I can think of a Māori writer, actually two of them, who are in the same, I've got to get this done, and I'll just ask my auntie, and it's all over, and it's fine, and it's done. And I'm sitting here thinking, no, you shouldn't do that.
So that's the same lack of research, yeah. lack of scrutiny.
Yeah, but then as well with certain people out there, it's the right to present your world as you see it. And who the hell am I with a PhD and a professorship to turn around and challenge them? You know, isn't that right? What do you reckon?
Well, having been told off by you for making a couple of mistakes, I don't mind being told off by an expert.
Thank you, Deb.
But people who should know better, who make a mistake, it annoys me. And it annoys me when people, it's easy enough to look most things up, it really
yeah,
is.
It really is.
So bloody well look it up.
Mm. Yeah. Check it out.
Yeah.
There you go. Emerging historical writers. Those are your writing orders. And I wonder if you two, as such experienced researchers and writers across so many different forms, do you have any tips for people who are just starting out writing historical fiction and feeling a little bit overwhelmed by the research?
Read. Read, read, read. Read all sorts of genres. Read lots of non-fiction. At the moment, I'm reading the history of poverty in New Zealand, Australia, the UK, and the US for the last few hundred years. I'm reading the history of economics in the same countries because it's informing what I'm writing about at the moment. Don't just read the genre you want to write in, because that's really going to box you in. Mm. Watch films and TV boxed sets that have good storylines. Frankly, what I learned from Breaking Bad, I could never learn anywhere else. Seriously.
That's really good.
Really.
So that's about storytelling. It's about dialogue and structure and
character.
And continuity.
Character. Yeah. Walter White, you can't beat him for an awesome character from Breaking Bad. Start writing and just keep going. Don't sit and dither for years on end. And I'm looking at someone.
She's looking at someone here.
Yeah, but you know, this person has been a professor for years and years.
You have had a bit on.
Yes, yes, I have, and I'm a, an exhibitions curator as well. So I've done big exhibitions as well.
Yes,
I'm a museum professional. What I wanted to say, not that I'm in a position to really speak because I've yet to produce my novel, is love what you do. You know, really enjoy it. Don't regard having to delve into the newspapers, the pictorial archives, the adverts at the back of some 19th century ladies' magazine as a chore. You know, make it a joy, because you don't know what you'll come across. You've got absolutely no idea what's out there waiting for you, but it will find you, and you will find it. Just don't treat it like a, you know, like a kind of task or a drag, because it's not. And what can happen, and this is only within my own, well, not so limited, but certainly in the research scholarship that I've done, is that you end up being carried off in another direction completely, and you end up with this entire new realm of fascination and possible storylines that you didn't ever expect to come across. And that's really good. It's really, really good. But yeah, read to repeat Deb, and enjoy. You know, love it. Go for it.
Fabulous. Yeah. Well, on that inspiring note, thank you both for your time today, and we look forward to hearing more from you in September.
Thank you, Kelly. Yes. Thanks, Kelly.
Always a joy. Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Melbourne, from the 8th to the 10th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Kate Forsyth, and Melissa Ashley. And our podcast guests, including Deborah Challenor, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Zulara Gentile, and Robert Gott. And me, I'm Kelly Gardner. You can find out more or buy tickets online from hnsa.org.au.